Okay, thank you, Sylvain. We're going to move on now to some short talks replacing Chuck's title. First, Jason Glenn. Jason seems we'll continue on the topic of molecular gas in feedback from star-forming galaxies. We'll...
Okay, thank you. I have 7 or 8 minutes to talk, I think. So I'm starting my timer now, and I'll make sure I don't go over and keep everybody late, although there are a couple talks after me. So I want to continue talking about molecular gas in galaxies, specifically as probed by carbon monoxide. These are generally not winds, although we have outflows in some of our galaxies. Carbon monoxide has in the past primarily been used as a tracer of molecular gas mass, but that's just because the low J lines, like 1 to 0 and 2 to 1, are primarily what have been observed. Herschel changed that a great deal. The Spire instrument could reach out to J equals 13 to 12, and the PAX instrument could go higher. And we found that with these observations, our understanding of the molecular gas was very different than it was pre-Herschel. So we've assembled a set here of 17 galaxies for which we have J equals 1 to 0 out to J equals 13 to 12. And what we find is that the low-lying lines, the 1 to 0 and the 2 to 1, are really good at probing mass. 90% of the mass in these star-forming galaxies generally is in a cool component, a low pressure component that's a couple tens of Kelvin. But 90% of the luminosity is in the high J lines. It's in a much higher pressure component that seems to be excited by star formation. Since I only have 7 or 8 minutes to talk to you, I decided to put all my main points and conclusions on the first slide, and then I'll show you plots that's not going to help my average at all. Then I'll show you some plots that back up what I'm going to say. So, two components of gas. 90% of the mass seems to be in a component where the pressure in units of Kelvin per cubic centimeter is about 10 to the 5, and the range on that is about an order of magnitude. 90% of the luminosity, however, is in a warmer, higher pressure component where the mean is about 10 to, 6 and, to the 6.5. And when we model this warm component of gas, what we find is generally it's got to be heated mechanically. It's not an ionizing source of radiation that's heating it. So it's got to be winds and turbulent input. It doesn't seem to be that photodissociation regions alone can explain the luminosity of the carbon monoxide in the warm component, because it would very much overpredict the amount of far infrared radiation that we see. The CO is very bright, and it's getting additional energy input. And furthermore, the cool component, the lower pressure component, is still an order of magnitude higher in pressure than giant molecular clouds in the Milky Way. And what I think is happening here, although it remains to be demonstrated, is that these star formation rates are high compared to the Milky Way, 10 times higher, in extreme cases, 100 times higher. And the cosmic ray production rate has to be much bigger. And that can heat the cool component of the gas, even where the photons aren't reaching. And the reason I think this is important is if the pressure is an order of magnitude higher, then that could well affect the star formation process and the stellar initial mass function and could bump it up to be top heavier. So if galaxies go through phases where they are Ulurg-like or even Lurg-like, it might be that their mechanisms of star formation are different than when they're in a more quiescent state, like the Milky Way. So I just want to show a few spectra to you. I made my slides over lunch, and I apologize for the labels being small, but it's because they came from my poster, which you can see tomorrow afternoon, and I'll be here to talk about it then again if you want to. The horizontal axes, and these are two plots that are the same, they just have different galaxies on them, so it's a little less confusing. Horizontal axes is the upper quantum rotational level of the carbon monoxide molecule, and the vertical axis is the luminosity scaled to Markarian 231, 1 to 0 line, just for clarity so that we can see here. And I want to point out a few things. Something that shows up terribly here is the spectral line energy distribution of the inner galaxy of the Milky Way. This is basically the molecular ring. And it peaks at very low J, and then it's basically not detectable for the most part after that. And that's what we think about when we think about star formation, molecular clouds in the Milky Way. These galaxies are very different. Their excitation is much higher. Another example here is NGC 6240, which has off the charts carbon monoxide emission, especially compared to its far infrared, and it's a Euler. There are also Seyfert galaxies in here, Markarian 273 and NGC 1068. These galaxies, their spectra, show evidence of AGN that's very clear. We can see X-ray dissociation in the high column densities of ionized molecules. But except for the Seyfert galaxies, the excitation in these galaxies is not from AGN. Even if AGN are present, it's the star formation, most likely, that's heating the gas. So those are just a couple of examples. How do we know there are two components present? Well, we model the gas using a non-LTE code with an escape probability formalism. And the main collision partner of carbon monoxide is hydrogen. Here's the plot, again, of rotational quantum number and line luminosity again. But here it's in radio astronomy units, Kelvin per kilometer per second. Okay, and so here, the low J lines look like they're brighter, but this is not luminosity. The energy isn't carried in the low J lines. But you can see you can't explain the spectrum with a low temperature gas. You need a high excitation component also to be present. So when we model it, this is what our likelihood distributions look like. So this is relative likelihood that's normalized to a peak at unity. For the luminosity in ergs per second or solar luminosities, the pressure in Kelvin, that should be centimeters to the minus 3, and column density of carbon monoxide. And you see that the low pressure and warm pressure components are well distinguished. The luminosity is carried in the warm, high pressure gas, but the mass is carried in the cool gas. So I'll just move on to my last slide here. And this shows a histogram of the gas pressures, so the energy content of the gas, in Kelvin centimeter to the minus 3. Here's the warm component in our galaxy sample. Here is the lower pressure cooler component. And here from our BOOLCAM galactic plane survey is divided by 7 because we have 3,000 clouds there. Is the pressure distribution of cloud molecular cloud clumps and GMCs in the Milky Way. We have a measure of their density, but not their temperature. So I assume two temperatures, 10 Kelvin and 30 Kelvin, shown as the dashed line. And what you see is even with the 30 Kelvin assumption, the cool, low-pressure component of the gas in these high star formation rate galaxies is much more excited than the bulk of the molecular gas in the Milky Way. So I want to end there and just say that this work is done by my group with Julia Kamenetsky, Nassim Rangwala, and Phil Maloney. And it's based on work on individual galaxies we did with the SAG2 Guaranteed Time group with Herschel. And Christine Wilson organizes that group. Thank you.
Thank you. We have time for a couple of questions. Yeah, Peter.
I was just wondering about the modeling with two components. I presume that you can just have a continuum as well.
You know, that's a good question. We've worried a great deal about this. So we found we could fit the spectra very well with two components. That doesn't mean that there are two components. You expect a continuum of properties. So we try fitting with more than two. For example, our warmest components are a few hundred Kelvin, in some galaxies approaching 1,000 Kelvin. And we know from H2 that there's 2,000 Kelvin gas out there, right? So we try fitting with three components, and what happens is we can fit as many as we put in, but the mass and the luminosity settle on these two components. So we can find a very warm component, but it's got a fraction of a percent of the mass in it, and it doesn't seem to be very important. So the H2 is a good tracer of the gas, but it's not carrying the mass. So something that I'd like to try next is, instead of fitting two components with distinct properties, see if we can represent this with a power law distribution and pressure. I'll bet we're going to be able to fit the data, but I don't know.
I saw another question. If not, we can move on with Alec.
So thanks very much. I'm Alex Diamond-Stanek. I'm a Granger Fellow at the University of Wisconsin. I unfortunately just showed up at lunch today. I just spent last night in Denver due to some travel problems. And I walked in the door, saw Nicholas, I saw Crystal, and they said, well, Chuck Seidel isn't here. We need to help people to put together their slides. So these are the slides that I put together. So take it from what they are. So my title slide, I'm posing a question. So can compact starbursts mimic quasar mode feedback? So this is getting a little bit at some of the questions that Sylvain was talking about, albeit for a very different for a different sample of galaxies. So I'm going to be framing this around a particular sample, and I'm showing data for three of the galaxies in that sample here in various forms. There's a lot of information that can be gleaned out of this if you would care to do so. On the left, our rest frame, UV to optical spectra of these galaxies. In the middle, I'm zooming in on a particular feature, the magnesium 2 absorption line, showing those profiles in wavelength and velocity space. And what's interesting about these galaxies is the fact that they have alpha velocities. In this case, the centroid velocity is 2,500 kilometers per second. And how do you make an outflow at that kind of velocity? And the punchline is related to what we're showing on the right here, which is actually the morphologies of these galaxies at roughly rest frame V-band. So on the left is the data, and the center is a one-component Galfit model. And on the right is the residual. This residual light is maybe 10 to 15% of the total. In all three cases here, the dominant light component almost looks like a point source. So it's basically, if you zoomed in here, you can almost see sort of the structure of the HST point spread function. And what that is telling you is that the dominant light component from these systems, and if I showed you more images, I could convince you that these look like the remnants of gas-rich major mergers, that what's producing this spectrum here, which is the spectrum of of a galaxy, is confined to a region of order 100 parsecs in size. And that the reason we think that actually star formation can drive velocities up to several thousand kilometers per second is basically a statement that if you have velocities being proportional to the radius at which you launch them, to the square root of that, 1 over the square root of that radius, if you have something that's an order of magnitude smaller than a typical galaxy, you're going to get an outflow velocity that's a factor of a few higher. And so that's basically the punchline, that we think in this sample of very compact starbursts, you can get quasar mode type feedback, where I'm really talking about velocities here, but also talking about energy and momentum, from incredibly compact starbursts. And just a few sentences about how these things were selected. They were actually mistakes in the Sloan Digital Sky Survey targeting, looking for quasars. These things are basically bright, they're blue, and they're compact. And we've confirmed that they're bright, they're blue, and they're compact. And basically, the data that we're showing here is getting to this picture that you can explain these kinds of outflows from star formation. Now, how would you produce a high-velocity outflow from star formation? Well, I said you could do it with a massive compact starburst. Well, why is that? Here are just two equation is showing this, 1 over the square root of the radius dependence. So this is if something comes out of the escape velocity. So this is sort of stealing from Murray et al. 2011. And again, if you have something that's launched from a very small radius, so basically Heckman 2011 is doing an integral from R0 to infinity, assuming some momentum input, and then normalized to a given column density, it actually turns out it depends on that launch radius, such that the smaller launch radius you have, the higher velocity you have. And you put plug in numbers, as Heckman did, you get 1,800 kilometers per second. So that's similar to what we're observing. And so the sample has basically the most extreme outflows in star-forming galaxies at any redshift. And the argument for why they have those is they have the most extreme physical conditions. And a point relevant to this meeting is that this question of what actually happens in the central, say, 100 parsecs of galaxies. Now, you know, if you're simulating something like a galaxy merger, the question of how much the black hole is growing, often you can prescribe that as like a Bondi accretion-type mechanism. But what if that gas formed stars instead and then did quasar mode feedback for you without having to necessarily fuel the quasar in a very strong quasar event? So to place this sample in context, I'm just going to make a plot of star formation rate, surface density versus stellar mass. I told you that these things are very compact. It also turns out that they're very bright in the infrared. They have high star formation rates, so they're going to be somewhat extreme in this star formation rate surface density. So I'm starting out with a comparison sample at redshift 1 from a paper from Woods et al. 2011. And this is basically 1, 2, and 3 sigma contours of the galaxies from that paper. I'm putting in this value here. This threshold for winds often quoted from it's actually a conference proceeding from Heckman 2002. Yet it gets cited quite a bit, of this 0.1 solar masses per year per square kiloparsec. this value right here was quoted as a limit that very few galaxies essentially at high redshift exceed this limit of about 25 in these units. So I'm just going to add in gas-rich major mergers. Several of these are from the Yu et al., I believe, 2008. This galaxy right here is actually ARP220. And then adding in the compact starbursts from the sample, we get overlap with the region of gas-rich major mergers extending to very high star formation rate surface densities. And if you look at values from, say, Thompson et al. 2005 or Hopkins et al. 2010, you get values of order 1,000 or a few thousand in this units of solar masses per year per square kiloparsec. So we appear to be seeing galaxies that have, if you take their star formation rate and you take their size, the star formation rate is estimated from the infrared luminosity, the size we're measuring at one band where we have the best resolution, we're getting values up to this theoretical limit. So here's a variety of questions. If I were going to give an hour-long talk, I would try to touch on several of these questions. I'm just going to mention them. So we've been talking about molecular gas. What's the molecular gas content of these galaxies? We have observations of now two of these systems with IRAM. If you look at CO and compare that to what the current star formation rate is, you infer a very high star formation efficiency, meaning that molecular gas is going to be consumed and expelled within the next, you know, about 10 million years. We actually just got a spectrum, which I don't know if I'm allowed to show you, but we actually see in one source a CO outflow that appears to have Markarian 231 type properties. But since these are slightly more extreme starbursts, you actually explain a spatially extended molecular gas outflow at redshift 0.6 as basically these maximal starbursts. So stay tuned for that. Properties of the outflowing gas. If I can, I'm going to show a couple slides of spectra. Basically, we're getting a very high resolution spectra with Keck. Which is basically the first time anyone's tried to do this for star-forming galaxies outside of basically the local universe. And we can learn about the velocity structure and potentially, you know, talk about the acceleration mechanism. Dushan talked about this a little bit earlier. In terms of AGN activity, basically they're dominated by star formation. Do these have local counterparts? There are some local galaxies that, you know, have very compact centers that are driving high-velocity outflows. This is just one sample. I'll show one slide comparing these to compact quiescent galaxies at higher redshift. Basically, these things are, if the stellar mass were as compact as the light, would be even more extreme than the centers of galaxies at redshift 2. I think the stellar mass is actually somewhat more extended than the light. But again, we might be forming, you know, the last few ultra-compact ellipticals. And then this question of the stellar mass is compact as the light, basically we're trying to measure it much better. So to put this in context, basically this is a sample at redshift less than 1 when most, you know, quiescent galaxies formed at high redshift. So these systems aren't particularly relevant themselves for, say, elliptical galaxy formation, but they could be analogous to the systems that formed at high Z, where you can't study in nearly as much detail. So this is Van Dokkum et al. 2008, sort of showing local Sloan galaxies and the sample of Z of 2.3 compact quiescent systems. So compact means 1 kiloparsec at about 10 to 11 solar masses. I've reproduced these points here, switching them to be red stars. And this limit is roughly the, you know, the central mass density limit of local ellipticals. If you put our sample on that same plot, again, this is taking just the half light radius. I think the half mass radius is probably so much larger. You're actually getting even more compact systems. You know, this system right here has a half light radius of 100 parsecs, yet it is almost 10 to the 11 solar masses. But again, this question of how compact the stellar mass is actually quite relevant if you want to say, what is the exact escape velocity at the center of these regions, and how does the observed outflow velocity compare to that escape velocity? And so just the last thing what I want to show is that related to feedback, you know, this is an optical spectrum. When we talk about measuring these absorption lines, here's a magnesium 2 line, iron 2 line. In this case, we actually even have a calcium 2 outflow for this particular source. These dotted lines show where the line should be, and these are all, in this case, it's blue shifted by about 2,000 kilometers per second. So this is a very good spectrum, very good at measuring outflow velocity. But you actually can do much better if you go to high resolution. So this is the same spectra, or same region of iron 2 and magnesium 2 at low resolution, about R equals 1,000, and then very high resolution, R of 40,000 with Keck. And when I'm actually in the next slide, zoom in on these lines just to prove that there's structure. But the fact that these lines are close to black at light center is actually telling you that this outflowing gas is covering essentially the entire background source at these velocities. And this is just a zoom in of basically those two profiles I just showed. And this profile here looks a little bit like Martin and Boucher, the fact that you see this velocity-dependent covering factor, that basically the gas is optically thick at all velocities, and you're covering the entire source at 2,500 kilometers per second, but say only 10% of the source as you go out to higher velocity. So this covering factor is actually velocity and ion dependent. So these are sort of some of the first measurements of that dependence, which we can try to compare to models. And this is just 6 out of 15 of those spectra that we have, showing that these large covering factors are actually common. Again, this is the first example of high-resolution spectroscopy of galaxy outflows outside the local universe. And it would be great to try to constrain the outflow acceleration mechanisms with this kind of data. So back to my original title question, can compact starbursts mimic quasar mode feedback? I would say, at least for this sample, the answer is yes. And the question I would pose to you is, can your feedback simulation produce outflow velocity profiles like this? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Alec. Questions? We have some time for a couple of questions. So feel free. Yeah, Peter, and then Silva.
Sorry for hogging the discussion. It is a fascinating object and beautiful. But one thing I wondered about also when I saw the paper is why are they so blue? Because if they're that compact and that massive, there should be a lot of metals and a huge column toward the star formation. Right. And so it's just, you know, I don't know why, but it's just something I wondered about.
So I think they're pre-selected to be blue, because basically they look in Sloan photometry like quasars. And I think a picture that could connect it is that if you actually take the rough hydrogen column we observe, it's close to 10 to the 20, if you put that at 5 kiloparsecs, which is a reasonable, perhaps a reasonable scale, one used in, say, Rupke and Beaulieu, if you bring that back to 100 parsecs, you'd actually infer a column of that's Compton thick, 10 to the 24. So you could have 10 to the 9 solar masses of gas ejected in an outflow. And basically, it has to be geometrically diluted by that factor of 10 to the 24 to 10 to the 20, and then you actually see it as being bright and blue. So then, go back in time, you know, we're only seeing this in this, oh, sorry, I just threw out the scenario, but we'd only be seeing this galaxy because it actually has just blown out the gas and dust that had been surrounding the nucleus.
Yes, Ivan?
I was just wondering if you have any estimates of masses and momentum and, you know, dynamics for these outflow?
Yeah, so I said I didn't show the plot of the CO. Basically, there's something like 10 of the 9 solar masses. So the CO outflow I didn't show. There's like 10 of the 9 solar masses. It actually looks to be spatially extended, you know, about a little more than an arc second. An arc second is like 7 kiloparsecs at this redshift. So you're starting to get close to 1,000 solar masses per year. The particular source, the star formation rate in the recent past, was at least a few hundred solar masses per year. If you go to the equations from your review article and ask how much you have from supernovae and stellar winds and add up an equal amount from radiation pressure, it's actually enough to balance the energy and momentum budget, which I think is a statement that the star formation rates we're getting are a little bit larger than the ones, say, from your talk. So it's a comparable, I think, in terms of the properties. Now, this isn't published yet, but comparable to the Markarian 231 properties in terms of outflow rate, required energy, momentum. And these particular starbursts seem to have about the right amount. But that does imply a pretty efficient coupling of both thermal energy and radiation pressure to do that.
Are there a last question? If not, then we can continue on with this last short talk before the discussion session.
The last talk will be by the chair. So I would like to continue the theme of observations about galactic outflows and show you some observations, some constraints on the galactic winds from using back-on quasars. And that will serve as a springboard for the discussion later. A lot of people ask me where I am. I'm here in southwest part of France at the University of Toulouse at this institute, the Institute of Research in Astrophysics and Planetology, which is a fairly large institute, but they do a lot of instrumentation for space mission, like the Curiosity mission or the Planck mission. And my collaborators are listed here. Ilan Schroeder is a PhD student starting this project with me. Using background quasars has a lot of advantages compared to other techniques. It provides radar information. As Sylvain said, it's very critical to know where the gas flow is to estimate outflow rates. It can also probe wind around any galaxy. This is sometimes a problem when you use traditional galaxy spectroscopy. You're limited by the flux of the galaxy you study. Also, background quasars provide you with all of the ingredients to estimate the outflow rates. As I said, the location of the gas, the outflow velocity, the column density that you can get along the line of sight, and also statistically constraints on the opening angle of the winds. The problem is that background quasars near star-forming galaxies are rather rare, so you have to devise strategies to constrain large and to build large statistical samples. Another downside is that background quasars can probe anything else around galaxies, whether it's not just winds, but all the gas that's in circumgalactic medium can be related to the disk or to accretion. And this is sort of my summary slide of the three points I want to make here in the 8 minutes, that there's, as Crystal mentioned, there's a strong azimuthal dependence on the quasar with strong magnitude 2 absorbers passing near galaxies. The dependence is with this angle from the major axis, as Crystal showed. This is seen not just in this sample of 12 objects, but on larger samples of around 50 galaxies. So pretty much wherever you look at, you see strong dependence on these azimuthal dependence. Rangmon, Baudeloy has shown that already in 2011. The second point I want to make is that the radial dependence is actually fairly tight. Has a dependence of 1 over b, where b is the impact parameter. So this is the absorption strength, so the column density goes as 1 over b, and you can understand that fairly easily in the context of a biconical wind, as I will show in a minute. In fact, if you can use very simple model for biconical winds to constrain directly the deprojected to constrain the properties of the winds, namely the projected wind speed and the outflow rates. And this is how the azimuthal dependence can be very well understood in the context of some numerical simulations. And I picked on this one from the ARIES group from Piero Madaro et al., showing the inflowing particle and the outflowing particles being not co-spatial. You see clearly that the inflowing particles are more or less aligned with a galaxy that is seen edge-on here, traced by low ionization lines like silicon 2 or silicon 4. Whereas the outflowing particles, as we have seen this morning and throughout the day, that the outflowing particles are more or less on the minor axis. So the picture that's being built is something like this, where you have outflowing material being ejected perpendicular to the galaxy, where and the accreted material is more or less spiraling in and losing angular momentum as it moves radially, or maybe not quite radially, but flow inwards towards the central object. And we have one constraint that appeared last year. I won't have the time to talk about it, just mentioning here in science, where we have a quasar passing here along near the major axis of this of the galaxy at redshift 2, where we're able to constrain the accretion rate by comparing the kinematics that you expect from very simple accretion flows and the kinematics that we saw in the data. The radial dependence is shown here. This is a diagram that is well known. This is the equivalent width dependence with impact parameter for magnetism 2 absorbers in quasar spectra. And if you collect data from the literature, you see a large cloud of points here that has been well known for many decades. But what's interesting now, if you divide these points in according to whether the quasar is aligned with the minor axis or the major axis, you get a very different answer. If you select the quasar that are aligned along the minor axis, so probing winds, presumably, you get a very tight correlation, in fact. So the radial dependence here for the magnesium 2 equivalent width as a function of impact parameter shows a 1 over R, 1 over B radial dependence. And that's very tight. I think that's one constraint, if you'd ask me, with the current state-of-the-art numerical simulations to see whether or not this is seen in the numerical simulations. The scatter here is very tight. It's 0.2 dec. And this is similar to probably if Chuck had been here, he probably would have shown his 2010 result where he looked at now background galaxies probing the halos of galaxies, star forming galaxies, where he showed that the, for instance, silicon 2 absorption in background galaxies in stacked spectra shows also a very shallow radial dependence with impact parameter. So I think these are open questions. We need to see whether or not this is seen in numerical simulations. So how do we constrain now the properties of winds with background quasars? Well, we use very simple, naive bichronicle wind flow, where you can imagine a number of large number of clouds being entrained in hot wind, and we simulate those clouds in a Monte Carlo sense with mass conservation and just radial wind speed. And we ask the question is, by shooting sight lines at different angles in this bichronicle flow, where you can see here the simulated spectra, and there is some stochasticity in the spectra due to the fact there is discrete number of clouds. As a function of inclination, from 90 degrees, as you would expect, the spectra is symmetric. And then as you go from more edge on, you have a more asymmetric profile. And the thing is that in observations, once you have observations of the galaxy on its inclination, everything else is left. The last free parameter is the wind speed. So what we do is we take observation of galaxies where we can constrain the galaxy inclination with respect to the quasar line of sight. Like in this case, it's around 50 degrees. From IFU data, and we simulate the profile and compare to the data and ask the question, what is the wind speed that reproduces the data? That's the only free parameter. And what we get is that the deep projected wind speed are tend to be very small, or not very small, but smaller than the escape velocity by a factor of half. So we don't see wind speed that are larger than the escape velocity. What's also more interesting is the loading factor. This is the loading factor as a function of circular velocity for this sample of redshift 0.1. But first, we can't differentiate between the different momentum-driven or energy-driven dependence of the loading factor, because we have a small dynamic range in masses, and we're trying to expand this currently. And the other thing that you see is that there are some outliers, and these outliers are actually where the quasar sightline is the furthest away from the galaxy. That is where you might expect the largest time delay effect that Dushan talked about. In particular, we're also using the loading factor measured at 80 kiloparsec or 60 kiloparsec, and we compare that with the instantaneous H alpha derived star formation rate. So we need to improve on this and see whether the scatter will decrease, and also expand on the mass range of galaxy masses. This is the redshift 2 sample, and to summarize, so we find that using bicorner quasar that winds are rather well collimated with a biconical flow of plus or minus 30 degrees. We find that the escape velocity is smaller in all cases. The wind speed is smaller than the escape velocity, so the wind traced by low ionization lines does not seem to escape the halos of galaxies. This travel far up to 80 or 100 kiloparsec with a very nice radial dependence, 1 over b, that you expect from a mass-conserved flow going 1 over r squared. And we don't know yet whether we can put observations on this loading factor as a function of galaxy mass, but we stay tuned, be able to do that shortly in the near future. I want to spend now 2 minutes on how we're going to do this by using this next-generation instrument, MUSE, that has been that has seen first light February 1st and is being commissioned currently. This is a giant IFU, 1 arc minute of field of view with good sampling spatially and a covering in wavelengths from 500 to 900 nanometers roughly. It will have AO, not right now, and very, very nice, very good sensitivity to reach very large deep. To reach very deep observations and sensitivities, in particular for the large-scale filamentary structures like the cold flows. I expect it to emit in lambda alpha, and we are at the flux level on the order, depending on which simulations, on the order of this level, 3 to the minus 19. Some first showcases from this instrument, from the commissioning data. This is nearby objects, planetary solar system objects that you recognize, some polar ring, globular clusters. The Orion Nebula has mapped. So the instrument seems to be working very well, sort of out of the box. You know, there's not much to do during the first commissioning. A planetary nebula here, and a throughput that's amazingly high, up to 35%. That is including the telescope. That's all I wanted to say in this short talk. And now we can move to the discussion mode. And to the discussion mode, I would like to say a few things, a few minutes, unless you have a question for
what. Question for you.
Okay.
Is that okay? Could you go back to the diagram that showed column density versus impact parameter?
Yeah.
Doesn't that set a very tight limit on the clumpiness of the material in the flow? The very small scatter that you see there, because essentially the beam that you're talking about is of the order of a parsec or so across, right? That's the projected size of the continuum emitting region of the quasar that's your background source. Yeah. And you're essentially skewering these things with sight lines of about that size. And what you find is with that sort of sampling, the column densities have a very small scatter at a given radius. And it seems to me that that's putting, unless you've left off non-detections, that's putting in a very tight constraint on how clumpy the flow could be. On scales of about a parsec.
Yeah, I think.
And you show a flow in your model that's very clumpy, and I think that's the picture that a lot of people have in mind. But your data seem to suggest a very smooth flow.
The data seems to suggest it is clumpy as well. So it's not sure if I understand your question correctly.
How do you get such a small scatter in that diagram if it's clumpy?
So they were not selected for having good inclination. So there's a sample of achieve point one when we can do the inclination. And so, and in fact, there are more points there. So this is the redshift point 1 from Betsy Patton and our paper, and also the redshift point 5 from Glenn. So there's a large number of points here. They're not selected particularly for this, but I think.
And the density always seems to be within a factor of 2 or so of the mean at that radius.
It seems like the density of clouds is a well-defined quantity as you move in, as a function of impact parameter. The clumping that you're mentioning is along the line of sight, and there we are in the regime where typically we have from 5 to 15 clouds along the line of sight.
And you know that from the velocities.
We know that from the velocities because we resolve the non-saturated lines when we can count the number of clouds.
So you're saying that's you've got enough clouds per line of sight that you've essentially approximated the average.
Right.
And that's why you're not surprised to see more scatter there?
Haven't looked in detail to this question, but I'm not surprised.
It's just, I see. Okay.
So, to start the discussion, I put here some very simple statements that I think most people would agree, that we have to understand why 90% or sometimes 99% of the baryons are not in galaxies. I think this is unclear to me where they go. We all know how to get rid of them. We have to put a monster in a bathtub. You need to eject them somehow and give them some energy. But where do they go? Because we don't seem to have good observations of where they're when they stay parked up there in the hill. The loading factor, we are starting to get good constraints on this. Model seems to prefer dependents that are 1 over v squared or so, but that 1 over v squared is also very shallow in mass. So if you use the Weyl relation between halo mass and circular velocity, so for me it's hard to understand how you have a strong effect of feedback in low mass galaxies because the dependence on mass is very small. Because remember, you have to eject 90% or 99% of the baryons. The growth rate and the main sequence is also a good constraint on feedback in the sense that it's not sensitive to feedback, and simulations and models have a problem to actually reproduce the amplitude of this specific star formation rate as a function of redshift. There's quite a number of papers on this. And I will also show later the star formation efficiency, I think, is this defined in Beruzzi and Conroy's paper, where it's the star formation rate divided by the halo accretion rate. It's very low, and I think that's an issue for feedback. And then these are the observational challenges or points that we need to meet for comparing simulations and observations, namely that the strong tight collimation that we see in the data, the extent in the low ionization lines of for the NOx gas. If the wind speeds are low and the winds don't escape, then where do they go? And particularly for me, it's still difficult to reconcile a 10% baryon fraction or baryon efficiency in L-star galaxies with the wind properties in low-mass galaxies, because these loading factors that you tend to need are super large for the low-mass end. So now the floor is up to you, open to you, and you can jump on this, disagree or agree with some of these statements.
Yeah, I can start. So actually, from the observations, I think there is a picture which is clear, is that you have this rather low wind velocity, which is basically half of the escape velocity, which means that you will be able to launch a fountain up to a significant fraction of the VL radius, but not beyond that. And so it will fall back, but it will take a lot of time to fall back, especially if you go to very large radii, like less than the VL radius, but still. And so I guess that's what you need to be able to self-regulate the star formation efficiency in the halo, is to put these baryons in this kind of waiting loop, like delay loop, and then to take the bathtub comparison. And so these baryons are waiting out there in the halo, and when they fall back, they again will form star, launch another wind, but the fact that you have so many baryons in this delay loop allows you to reduce the star formation efficiency, basically.
Yeah, it works. Shouldn't we be seeing those baryons?
Well, I think you do see them in the metals that are spread out pretty far out in the halo, right? So metals are probably...
You see the metals, but do we see the baryons?
Yeah, on that point, I think it's interesting observation is the incidence of metal lines in random quasars. There's a lot of emphasis now on things close to galaxies. But if you just check the low column density metal lines that you see in any random sideline, there are so many of them that if you want to reproduce that with galaxies, and you just draw circles around each galaxy down to the lowest mass galaxies that can form stars, those circles for these low mass galaxies have to be much bigger than the Vero radius. So all the theorists seem to be saying metals don't get out beyond the Vero radius, and maybe observations at low redshift showing this as well for dwarf galaxies. But if that's the case at high redshift for dwarf galaxies, then we have a problem, and we don't understand how the metals got into the intergalactic medium.
Yeah, I think it seems like we all agree that feedback played an important role, and we need feedback to eject the metal somehow. But it's not clear that there's a complete agreement between the observations and simulations. Though I was impressed by the simulations this morning. And I think in a few years, probably, there will be more comparison between simulations and observations at the same level. Does someone else want to jump on it? Yeah. No?
So just following up on Joop's point, I mean, so there was just a conference at Irvine. Bunch of the people here were at, that there was a lot of talks on the sort of metal budget in nearby galaxies. And the impression I got very strongly from the observations was that, you know, we're not necessarily closing in on all the baryons, but we do seem to be observationally closing in on all the metals. The sort of, you know, there aren't that many missing metals anymore relative to what we think stellar populations have produced. And actually that, you know, the impression was that most of that is not, can't be in the IGM. It's actually, you know, in and close to galaxies.
But that's not that also what I'm saying. Because mm-hmm. the metals in the IGM that you see in random sidelines, the low column density ones, those account only for a very small fraction of the metals. Most of them are in the stronger systems. But that's actually in terms of volume filling factor, those are the only ones that are relevant. And they put very strong constraints on how far out some winds need to go. But if you compare it with the metal production, it'll be a tiny fraction.
Okay. So I think, I mean, this needs to be addressed then quantitatively, because I think we all do agree.
So we did a paper, Craig Booth et al, yeah. 2012, I think, where we did a toy model comparison to see just how, what kind of filling factors you need just to get the rate of incidence is observed in the local Manistee metal lines at high redshift. Mm-hmm. And it's a very, it's very clear that you need to go beyond the Vera radius for small galaxies just to get enough of them. Okay. But there's very few metals in that phase.
Yeah. So wouldn't it be easiest to put those metals at large radii if you did it with dwarf galaxies at a very early time because they're clustered around the big galaxies? I mean, we do have measurements of the clustering of metals at, you know, redshift 4-ish, and they're distributed more smoothly than galaxies are at that time.
So I see Dushan's hand is up, and I was actually going to ask him a question, so this might be a way to segue. You said that the disks that were forming, so I guess this is for everyone from the fire group, the disks that were forming at late times, and presumably from metal-enriched gas. And I was just curious if you could track what becomes an extended disk, you know, particle at low redshift, where that came from. If it was, you know, produced, you know, at high redshifts, launched in an outflow, what its dynamics were, how long it stayed in the halo, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, we can track it, and hopefully we will soon, but I don't have any numbers to share with you at this point. But I wanted to go back to, I think that is interesting, and it will give us some constraints about what's going on in CGM and what's feeding galaxies at late times and how much of that was recycled. But going back to Job's point, I mean, the examples I showed from Sasha's work was that only a fraction of the stuff leaves virial radius, but there is still a significant amount of mass that does leave virial radius. Just that 70% of the stuff that crosses quarter of the virial radius stays in. But metals are leaving and outflows are leaving virial radius. Just a small fraction of what was launched initially.
Do you know what the state of the gas is at the half virial radius? Or?
So for the one example we showed, it was basically half cold, half hot of the stuff that was flying out of virial radius. In the inner halo, it was almost completely cold. But we didn't check the metallicity of that stuff yet.
Anybody else wants to talk about this?
So I have a question for the observers. It seems that the picture that is emerging is some kind of repeated outflows with gas falling back onto the galaxy and for many cycles. We see that nice breathing mode in the star formation rate, in the star formation histories from all those simulations. So the question I have is, do we see evidence of wind gas falling back onto the galaxy? Is it something hard, like to distinguish between pristine infalling gas from metal-enriched infalling gas from a previous generation of winds? Is this something hard to do, certainly?
Well, when the quasar sightline are aligned with the major axis, in those situations, we don't see, or very rarely, pristine gas. It's mostly re-enriched. Crystal, you want to say?
Ago on the O6 absorption in local halos, and that this is correlated with specific star formation rate in local galaxies. And that group has followed on with a recent paper that Jess Work led. And, you know, as is often the case, sometimes it's more interesting when things don't agree, right, than when they do, because that's when we're about to learn something. And at least my impression is that there's a real problem here in that when they if they try to fit the O6 column densities with photoionization models, they get extremely low densities. So then if you say, okay, the O6 is collisionally ionized, I won't try to fit that, but try to fit the other line ratios, they're still getting I mean, larger, but still very low densities that imply very low pressure. So warm clouds that would not be in pressure equilibrium with a hot halo. And I mean, I'm curious, right, in the simulations whether any such gas is seen in any sort of model, but I mean, I'd be surprised if it was, right? Or if it is, I'd like to understand under what circumstances it is. Of course, it's possible, right, that the gas is not photoionized and we're applying the wrong model to interpret these densities and pressures, but I'm curious if other people are thinking about this or if it's not a problem for some reason that I'm missing.
Anyone wants to jump on this comment?
Sort of qualitatively, this note wanted to mention that there's been a big push on the theory side for this picture that the observers should be looking for these pristine filaments that are punching through and coming right and bringing new accretion onto the galaxies, but I think there are questions being that all these models in the last few years have been raising about the extent to which that's really true. If there's all these baryons cycling through the halo that have a lot of metals in them, how disentanglable are the inflows and outflows really going to be? It's certainly not as simple as I think the theorists have partly liked to convince themselves, I know I have, of this picture that we can just completely cleanly, we take the inflow rate from our simulation with no feedback, and then we put some multiplier in that represents feedback escaping, perpendicular to that, and never the two shall meet. And I don't actually think that's true, but I think a lot of previous work has been founded on that idea, and I think we need to look more carefully at that.
Actually, in that context, I'm not sure I should bring this up, but what happened to cold flows? Are they now a repoed away, or?
So we probably should wait for Avishai to be here.
Well, and that they're important. I mean, it's actually the main mode of star formation in massive galaxies at high redshift, that they actually bring in a good chunk of gas and are not just, a 10% effect.
Christian, you want to respond to this?
I mean, that's the stuff basically that become complicated because of all these winds. They are mixing in their material, and the issue with AREPO simulation was basically how deep the cold flows go in the massive halos at redshift 2 and whether we see cooling from the Hadron atmosphere or not. But in the lower mass halos, especially at high redshift, you kind of see them in mesh simulations in RAMSES and even in some AREPO simulation, depending on the halo mass and redshift, still see these things happening. But the problem with those simulations is that those were all simulations without strong winds. So now when you start implementing these strong outflows from the galaxy, situation will become much more complicated, and hopefully we'll start looking into these issues of how much material actually gets in kind of more closer to the initial IGM accretion than to the recycled winds. But we didn't do it yet.
If I just can jump in on this, I just want to mention that Freke van der Voort's thesis actually did look at the effect of feedback on the cold flows and on the accretion. But your question actually has an easy answer, because you asked, do massive ellipticals get most of their star formation from cold flows? And even pre-AREPO, everybody agreed that that was not the case. Most of their stars, was the claim, came from cold flows, but most of their star formation came from hot accretion. Because they formed most of their stars at earlier redshift, at high, not right now when you see them.
By the idea that at high redshift, most of the gas is being brought in by inseparable mergers being the units that bring in all the mass, I think most of the peers would still agree with them. So if that's your definition of cold flows, sort of rapid accretion of, you know, subvarial temperature gas, I think most people would still agree with that. I think a lot of the debate has been things like how mixed is it? Is it actually shocked? I mean, there's a whole technical question about does it undergo a variable shock? So you have retro simulations, not a lot of gas was technically undergoing a shock, but it's still cooling fast in these low mass isolation cases. Yeah, it's not setting up a big hydrostatic halo.
Maybe in the last few minutes, I would like to debate this this other version of the low baryon fractions in low mass halos. So we have seen from Andrea this morning already the abundance matching result giving a strongly peaked mass dependence for the galaxy formation efficiency. But in this analysis by the Stanford group of galaxies at a variety of redshifts over a large range of stellar mass, essentially what they do is look at the luminosity functions and the clustering to construct halo occupation models and tie this as a function of redshift to derive the growth rate of halos, and they can compare that to the star formation rates in galaxies. And they find that the star formation efficiency, the sort of star formation rate to baryonic accretion rate, which is essentially the dark matter accretion rate times the baryonic fraction, also a very strongly peaked dependence. For me, maybe somebody can understand and explain it, but for me this is a problem for feedback because the star formation rates are low and you need to have large star formation rates because you need to have large outflow rates. And then what happens to all of the other 90% of the accretion? Does the gas, the growth rate of halos is still the same?
I was just going to say one thing that I think this plot and those like it illustrates that lots of people have been seeing is that, you know, this, if you have all your low mass galaxies, if we somehow solve the low mass galaxy problem, we should also be aware that you know, this actually makes the sort of high mass problem harder because now we've got all these extra baryons around at late times that haven't been turned into stars that are metal enriched, so their cooling time is order of magnitude enhanced. And if they're really sticking around in the halo, like we were all just saying, that's kind of a terrifying prospect for solving the sort of classic cooling flow problem at the massive end here. And I think lots of people have found that you know, as you fix the low mass end, if you don't include something else, your massive end gets more and more disastrous.
Does anyone want to comment on this? I don't know, is this a obvious why the star formation efficiency or star formation rate to accretion rate being low in low mass galaxies?
Feedback.
But then how do you get all the baryons out if you have a low star formation rate to beginning with? You need to have huge loading factors.
Sure. Well, this.
Well, she says it's easier because they have a lower potential well, but then we've seen that the wind speed are actually scaling with the circular velocity. So in low mass halos, then the wind speed is higher, comparable to the halo. So they
have a quick follow up on that. So one of the things that we and everybody else who's been doing this on the theory side has been finding is that what helps you get these strong outflows is that the star formation is strongly clustered in both space and time. And I know that the people working on star formation have thought a lot about, both observationally and theoretically, the clustered in space part of that. I'm curious, you know, how much do we know sort of in the galaxy and the local group about the clustered in time aspect.
Well, that's not by Mark, but then if we have to close.
Yeah, I can address that. So we know a fair bit because you can constrain that from H alpha to UV ratios. So the observational constraint is that, you know, the H alpha is sensitive to ionizing photons, and that so flickers up and down on the time scale of the lifetime of an O star, whereas the FUV integrates over about 10 times that long, of order 50 million years. And so the amount of clustering in time strongly affects the distribution of H alpha to UV ratios. And so there's certainly a significant amount of clustering in time. The data are consistent with, and you can't say anything more than consistent with, stars form with a cluster mass function that's dn dm goes like m to the minus 2, and where the expectation value of the star formation rate equals whatever you put in, and the clusters, the actual cluster creation times, are then Poisson distributed subject to that constraint.
All right, well, thanks again to all the speakers for this afternoon, and close for today. We'll start tomorrow at 9 o'clock.
So yeah,